The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome, dear listener, to Echoes of Escheaton, a solo play Degenesis podcast that lets the dice rolls tell the story. You'll find the gripping narratives in this apocalyptic setting unfold before your very ears. You'll hear stories of loss and injustice, redemption and hope. A miasma of gloom drifts across the barren wastes, while nightmarish beasts roam and terrorize cities and settlements. Only mankind's inexhaustible will to survive offers the faintest glimmer of hope on the horizon. The echoing shades of the bygone peoples lingers on the wind and on the lips of survivors in this hell on earth. What stories will they tell? Pseudo and Etta maneuvered through the crowd past the Mulhouse exit, the sounds and smells of cookware and trade items clattering and slapping, mixed in with their hurried footsteps. Sergeant Nielsen was sitting casually on a shabby wooden supply crate as other clanners behind him balked at his presence while they doused small campfires and stowed their gear for travel. The other clanners around him draped thick patches of cloth and hand-woven shawls over their shoulders, and they test-fit shoddy gas masks over their children's faces, the cracks and the old rubber stretching as far as they could without tearing or breaking. Etta bore a look of worry.
Shit. I don't have a mask or breather tube. Is that somewhat of a problem, Sergeant Nielsen?
More than somewhat. Thin air may make you dizzy, but inhaling tar mist will make you dead.
Pseudo heard the conversation and fished a gas mask she traded with the haughty scrapper inside Mulhouse from her bag, and she passed it behind her to Etta.
I kept an eye out for you. Here.
Resourceful and cheeky.
Pseudo remained silent and stared up.
Breathing is one problem solved, but I don't want to go blind either. I think if I affix this kerchief here...
She laid her thick scarf inside the mask, and its extra material spilled out underneath the rubber and plastic clasps. She squeezed it over her head as best she could and said with a muffled voice,
"How does it look?"
"Like it was made by a scrapper with an ass for hands,"
Nielsen replied.
"There's not much more for it, I'm afraid. I was able to requisition enough supplies and were well kitted for the journey, but that could be a problem as we get closer to the Reaper's Blow. Keep an eye on your vitals, and we'll stop to check its integrity as we need to. Let's roll out."
Etta removed the mask and raked the mess of her short, dark brown hair back into some semblance of order. Frustrated pleas came from the parents with fussy children who swatted away the stifling rubber veils. The pleas of the parents grew faint as the trio fell in amidst the dozens of travelers preparing to make the trek across the snow and dust-ridden peaks to Basil and then the fortress, floating at a distance like some fantastical castle in the clouds. Mulhouse was but the first in a series of increasingly secure military checkpoints. The even more secure Basil checkpoint had more than double the amount of Helvetic specialists that marched around the outer perimeter. Among them were radio beam units with their broadcast receiver packs slung over their shoulders, paired with grenadier crack shots, along with the odd field medic. The line for passing through was as rigid as Mulhouse, even without the dousing spray of diluted fungicide. But Etta and Pseudo's entry was expedited, thanks to the access granted by Sergeant Nielsen. The interior of Basil was also similar to Mulhouse, filled with scrapper traders, migrants from regional intersections, but with much fewer Spitalian medical staff. It seemed that Mulhouse was truly the first line of defense against the spore carriers coming any further. But Basil wasn't without its defenses either, and some things are more powerful deterrents than strength in numbers. Only two Famulancers stood on the outside of the rear exit with their splayers held at attention. While Pseudo seemed unfazed at the crowd and contentedly pressed forward, a marked difference in these splayers captured Etta's eye. These pikes featured a glass tube affixed to the normally empty portion of the haft that Kiefer wielded. The tube was filled with a cloudy white liquid, and something bulbous and misshapen floated inside, remaining motionless. It looked like some grotesque portable science experiment from the labs inside the Spital. Etta tapped Matthias on the shoulder and whispered so as not to interrupt any salutes he made at higher-ranking officers as they passed.
I haven't seen that before. What's in those splayer tubes?
Some sort of spore detector. I think they're called mollusks. Word around the Alpine mess hall says that they're the hearts and tissues carved right out of a psychonaut by those battalion commandos. If they start to twitch in those jars around you, well, let's just say this battalion's taking you in for a thorough evaluation.
Etta felt a shiver run down her spine. She had turned in many apocalyptic burn peddlers in Justicia, and once they'd been charged by the Senate, she'd seen the worst offenders get sent to the local hospital, not the Cleft. A handful were never seen again. The open air and a broad path made for an easy walk up the early twisting paths and short switchback trails that crisscrossed steep foothills. Broad lanes made passing slower carts and parties easy for the trio, and after a few hours' time, the elevation they gained allowed everyone to look back and down at the concrete overlook towers of Mulhouse, now just tiny pinpricks in the distance. Not only had the elevation changed quickly, but so had the mix of people passing through. Clanners that came and went spoke different tongues than the typical Borken and Franken that served as the majority of passers-by. Guttural barks and harsh syllables issued forth from Pergan bog workers and harvesters, creating a cacophony of mingling culture over the sweeping lanes. The faces changed, too, in even harsher contrast with the languages. Brown and blonde hair was replaced with raven and chestnut colors, and the straight, hawkish noses of old Western Europe were replaced with broad and bent nostrils, less accustomed to breathing in desert dust, and more used to breathing in the humidity from the Pergan swamps and lowlands. Most telling of all, however, was the heavy fleece shawls twinkling with polished bronze and gold tassels, soft woolen pants and shoes with ornate woven patterns, and the decorative ram horns adorning the new influx of warm-skinned pilgrims coming and going on the trail. The Jahamadans, the carriers of God's countenance, were numerous and thriving in this part of the world. A Jahamadan's life is determined from the day he is born. He will fulfill his duties within the family, like his father and grandfather before him. They honor the family as decreed by Jahamad, the last prophet. As a young Ismaili, the Jahamadan herds his family's goats and imagines how life would have been as an Isaaqi, a blessed child. What feats he would have achieved. But he knows his place. He winds his phylacteries tighter and calls himself a fool. Someday, the teachings of Jahamad will give him a second chance. As a sword of Jahamad, he may fight the Anabaptists and other scum to prove his worth to his kin. He will then find a wife, a Hagari, and start his own family. The cycle begins anew. And yet, there is a third path. This boy may one day heed the call of Ares, the ram-headed one with his undulating ebony fleece stretched across broad shoulders. The Ares Initiate, or Arianoi, may come to learn more about the unknown truth of the Jahamadans than he ever desired, or he may perish in the pursuit of illumination. Until then, the tradition of the Shepherder, attendant to family and flock, will remain his guiding light.
Do you like your tabletop RPGs to be grim, gritty, and grounded? If so, then Legend of the Bones is the podcast for you. A mix of old-school solo D&D and dark fantasy storytelling. In Legend of the Bones, the dice rule. There are no rerolls, no fudging the dice, no meta currency. The roll of the bones will determine the character's destiny, and no one will be spared their fate. None shall escape the destiny of bone.
The party is well set on the hard path from Mulhouse, through the basal checkpoint, and across the trading and troop routes of the Alpine Tunnels, before finally traversing the magma river of the Reaper's Blow. The journey to pass the Reaper's Blow, which separates eastern and western territories of Pergaray, will last about 22 days. They can cover lots of ground with Matthias's help, traveling underneath the peaks in dugout tunnel systems that generations of Helvetics have maintained to this day. This is another overland travel segment, and I'll be rolling every 2 days of travel from a new table I created, and I'm going to rule that the chances for peril and danger are marginal at best, since this area is well protected by Helvetic forces. Alright, buckle up, gang. We're headed through the Alps to the Ropen Customs Station at the end of the junction of the Reaper's Blow, in one of the most heavily traveled and fortified portions of the Hard Path. Days 1 to 2. The chill in the air crept in slowly, building sheets of frost layer by layer across the sparse vegetation. It was a welcome reprieve to Etta, Pseudo, and Matthias, already dressed head to toe in heavy leather, plastic, and ablative ceramics. A bit of snowflake fluttered through the air and dissolved on Etta's bare cheeks. She wiped the droplets of frozen crystals from her rosy cheeks, touched by the cold, and couldn't help but smile at the foreign sensation.
"This cold rain feels so refreshing,"
she remarked happily. Pseudo rubbed her own cheek and gazed down at the condensate on her glove, unwilling to remove her mask.
"I will take your word for it,"
she said rather blandly. Matthias wrapped a piece of gray and white checkered cloth around his neck, the thinnest part of his skin-tight harness armor.
"I'm sure you'll have more refreshment than you can stand in a few weeks, Judge. Bundle up,"
he said. The unbroken ascent into the Alps continued, and small piles of dirty snowmelt slush began to litter the ground. Etta was intrigued at the sight, and removed her warm leather glove to plunge a hand into the portion of the pile still unsullied with mud. The freeze bit her hand and sent a tingle up her elbow.
"Whoa, if the ice barrier penal workers have to contend with this..."
She trailed off, now absorbing the full scope of the pure, white-capped peaks still leagues away. She swirled her hand in the slightly melted crystals and felt something stiff buried in the snow pile. She withdrew a bent and heavily rusted symbol of the Anabaptist broken cross in her reddened and slightly numb fist. The icon had been trampled over, forgotten. Her earlier enthusiasm dipped as she stared at the relic and grew uncomfortable holding it. Maybe it was her imagination, but it seemed to grow colder the tighter she squeezed, as if all the spiritual comfort and warmth that once had to offer was completely expelled in this wintry landscape. Come to think of it, she hadn't seen a single Anabaptist forehead tattoo or nose ring in about a month or so. How much had the cult's presence diminished? She set the broken cross back on the ground gently and backed away from it. Then she swallowed, furrowed her brow to find some grit, and hastily threw on her glove, hustling to catch up with her other two companions. Days 3 and 4. Tarnished metal signs buried in stacked rocks offered waypoint markers for those crawling up the Alps. Several shady-looking characters gathered off to the side of the trail beckoned the trio over. They mentioned that some of this signage has been swapped to mislead travelers into dangerous off-trail routes proffered as shortcuts. These bandits request 10 drafts to tell the party what signs are true and which ones aren't for the next several kilometers. Matthias looks them up and down, obviously distrusting of this potential trap. He's navigated these passes before, although it has been a while since his initial training run. How confident is he? Let's find out. He'll roll an instinct plus orienteering check. Difficulty, 2 successes. Action number, 5 dice. And he meets with success.
"I think we'll be fine on our own. Break it up and move on, or I'll radio the next patrol that some rotten bastards ahead are intentionally fucking up Helvetic army property,"
Matthias warned. The bandits exchanged sneering looks and began gathering their packs to relocate. Days 5 and 6. Camping on the mountain slopes offered a separate series of discomforts that the windy flats from several weeks ago couldn't compare to. But Matthias has the survival skills to show the ladies the best way to avoid toppling over while they slumber. For emphasis, he tells a rather lengthy story about how it took 2 full days to extract a stranded Helvetic recruit from his training blind, all because he rolled over in his sleep and got wedged in the gap of an escarpment. Etta can see her breath in the morning, and she stuffs discarded ration cloth inside her vest and coat for insulation. Days 7 and 8. Clear mornings make easy starts for the party, as the Alpine Fortress hides its towering frame behind stone spikes and thin boulders. The group spies white smoke drifting out from behind the jutting terrain, and a small procession of Jahamadans are heading towards it, coercing the stubborn sheep in front of them with hooked staves. Around the slough of rocks and patchy brown grass, the smell of roast meat and incense wafts past the party's nostrils, causing all of them to salivate as they stumble upon a religious scene. A gilded hierogram was stacked atop a large ram's skull, with a smoldering censer swaying gently between the multiple ridges of the horns. Chanting and low moaning from the arriving Jahamadans were offered up to bless a sacrificial lamb which had already been skinned, gutted, and portioned for those partaking in the ceremony. The trio looked on from the back before an elderly woman with radiating tattoos across her face and entire body brought a few steaming strips of flesh to them. They all graciously accepted, including Sudo, who briefly disappeared around the boulder to munch on hers, sans mask. The old woman looked Matthias up and down with weary eyes and said,
"Young battler, do not pray to stone and weaponry. Seek God's providence instead of your doctrine. Blessings be with you all."
Matthias patted the trailblazer at his side, responding with a mouthful of hot lamb meat.
"Divine intervention doesn't move at 1,000 meters per second. Thanks for the vittles, though."
Days 9 and 10. While snow piles had dotted the mountain paths for several days, and occasional flakes fell lazily in the breeze, the first real snowfall of the journey began, making Etta regret she'd ever used the word refreshing at the outset. Her socks and boots were in good repair, even after being soaked for a day on the path to Ignatz, but warmth seemed to leach from her with each passing step in the fresh white powder. If Sudo was miserable too, she was certainly keeping a tight lid on it. Matthias's reinforced wedge boots and greaves waded through the ankle-high snow, carving a path forward in the ice. Days 11 and 12. In the proximity of the Reaper's Blow, the ever-churning fiery rift in the Earth's crust, smoke bellows and belches from inside the hellish fissure. In the right conditions, when mountain winds relent and volcanic activity in the fissure rises, great plumes of smoke are carried west, depositing silt and choking the air with sulfuric ash particulates. The party starts clearing their throat more often as they travel, and their noses begin to itch, as the already thinning air is replaced with hazardous fumes. They pass other, less fit travelers, heavily spread out as they march on. Several caravanners have stopped to catch their breath with red eyes and coughing fits. Matthias knows the telltale signs and will make an instinct plus survival check to see if the severity is cause for alarm. Difficulty, 2 successes. Action number, 4 dice. With 2 triggers on the roll, the Helvetic knows it's time to check their breathing gear should the conditions quickly worsen. Matthias puts on his baffled face guard and tightens the squat breathing filter onto the threads.
"Check gear and mask up. We've got eruption plume drift."
Etta's garment-filled mask provides some reprieve, although her mouth and throat still slightly tingle with the fine dust, but it will have to suffice. Her depth perception is mitigated from the mask's missing eye lens being covered by a thick cloth, and she asks to place a hand on Sudo's shoulder as they walk over slick ice patches. Sudo is frustrated to have to slow the pace and stays tense for the rest of the day, much to the embarrassment of Etta.
"Hey. I'm sorry, Sudo. I need your help just like you needed mine at Mulhouse."
"I didn't ask for your help,"
Sudo thought tersely. The small filters in her chronicler's mask kept her breath and mind steady, focusing on the task feed rolling through her mind every waking second. Progress is slow but continual as they pass another set of peaks left behind in the yellowish haze. Days 13 and 14. The clarifying gusts return mid-morning after an extended breakfast, and the dingy yellow skies above take on their normal azure tint once more. The party stows their masks and their travel kits. Matthias mentions that despite the hitches and pace from the previous days in the haze, they are over the halfway point. Another small valley offers a rather steep climb with overgrown portions of the hard path continuing up. Matthias is the first to top the hill as Etta and Sudo both grab their knees from exertion.
Even with clean air, I can't seem to catch my breath.
This one requires more oxygen.
Matthias laughed, shrugging off the minor altitude sickness thanks to his extensive training.
You and every other poor soul sucking eggs up the hard path. Once you catch your breath, get ready to lose it again. Look.
The women looked up from being doubled over and were greeted with a majestic and imperial sightline of the stronghold of the Helvetics, the mighty Alpine Fortress. Thanks for listening to this episode of Echoes of Escheton. The music for the show is provided by Tabletop Audio, original 10-minute ambience and music tracks for your games and stories. I'd like to extend my gratitude to my talented and expanding voice cast for their hard work. Lyric as Etta Youngbao, Wing Newt as Sergeant Matthias Nielsen, Muinmos as Pseudo 19. I met these fine folks on the social platform Discord. Discord is an amazing way to keep up with listeners and other fans of the show. Users have the ability to chat with voice and video calls, instant messaging, and can share media in private chats or as part of a larger community called a server. I like the platform so much, in fact, that I started an Echoes of Escheton Discord server. You can find the link to join my server in this episode's description on your podcatcher app or web portal, on my Twitter profile link tree, or on the homepage of my new website, echoesofescheton.com. If you would like to support the show, there are multiple ways to do so. You can share this post-apocalyptic fiction podcast with a friend, like and retweet show announcements on Twitter, or leave a rating on your podcatcher of choice. If you join the Echoes of Escheton Discord server, you'll be able to interact with lots of fun folks from around the world. Here's a review left in the episode Spoiler Talk channel on Discord. Just wanted to comment on the stellar writing. I love how so much flavor of the world comes through from the word choices in the narration and dialogue. It really captures the DeGenesis mood. I also really appreciate the snippets of dice rolls and the skill purchasing. It's a great balance between fiction and mechanics that really works for me as a listener. That was from our lovely voice talent, Lyric. Thank you so much for the kind words. Come join the fun and get a reading from the Apocalyptic Tarot. I wanted to share my heartfelt gratitude for everyone who shared and rated the show so far. Until next time, dear listeners.